I'll be changing the subject fairly often at times. 29 states in the United States now have no-fault divorce laws. All the other states except Nebraska have the option, and there is a strong pressure group presently in Nebraska trying to force them to add that option to their law books. Now, this reduces a divorce court in the no-fault situation to primarily a court that divides the assets of the two. That may sound rather simple, but sometimes that works a great hardship, especially on the woman, if the house she lives in must be sold, the proceeds divided, the car sold, the proceeds divided, if that's the only way to reach a fair and equitable settlement as the judge sees it. Now, God's law, and you recognize, of course, that no fault has increased the divorce rate considerably, and it will rise more. God's law very simply said, what man has joined together, let not man put asunder, and that was his intent from the beginning. God has never changed his mind, never will. One man, one woman. That's the way God always wanted it. And his rules for divorce are so simple, childishly simple, that I don't know how we can ever make a mistake in understanding them. He says in two scriptures, Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19, verse 9, there is one scriptural reason for divorce that God accepts. That is sexual unfaithfulness by one of the partners. When that's said, it is all said. Simple, concise, God's law versus man's law. Which will we take? Civil courts generally fix certain amounts to be paid by a husband when he is considered to be more at fault than the wife in some of the old-fashioned courts, and he is asked to pay alimony or child support. I'm not sure why it is that husbands have taken such a dim view of child support payments. They don't seem to be quite as opposed to alimony as they are child support. I would think it would be the other way around. I would think they'd have more concern for their children than they might have for someone they've been arguing with for years. But it doesn't seem to be the case. At any rate, men will move, change address, even quit working to avoid paying child support payments. Now, you could look until you get very tired and you would never find this subject mentioned in the Bible, because God is not in the habit of legislating on things that he wholeheartedly disapproves of. In other words, things that he doesn't even want to come up. Things that shouldn't come up. But there is one thing I have never understood and never will. I do not understand how a father's responsibility with his children ever ends, no matter what happens to a marriage. Bankruptcy laws in some states, in fact, most, are becoming much more lax. For example, if we went across the line into Kansas, we could keep $10,000 in cash, our house and our car. That doesn't sound exactly like a bankrupt individual. In Missouri, you keep the house, you keep the car, but you can only keep $2,000 in cash. So we're not quite as generous here. Naturally, people try to go to courts in Kansas because they get better treatment. But our bankruptcy laws seem to be more and more sympathetic with those who shirk their responsibilities. This is the strange thing about this. Hardly anyone involved in a bankruptcy can say, somebody made me do this. We do this ourselves with poor management, poor planning. Maybe a natural catastrophe of some kind or an emergency might have triggered this. But a good part of the time, it is our own negligence, our own inability to manage our affairs that brings us to this pass. But somehow we feel that we shouldn't be responsible for that. And we turn to the law for an easy way out. I don't believe that God would approve of an individual taking the easy way out, because a debt is a debt, and I think we should honor it as such. In Romans 13, verse 1, we find the word untrustworthy as a characteristic of evil people, because God's people are to be trustworthy. We're told in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 21, that whatever things we provide in the sight of men should be honorable or honest. And if we owe a debt, it is the honest thing to pay it. We're told also in the book of Romans, chapter 12, verse 17, that we should have a high regard for good things in the sight of all men. In other words, if we want a clear, stainless image before God, we will honor debts just as we honor promises. Ever since the Roe versus Wade fiasco by the United States Supreme Court, abortion has been subject to much public controversy. We've had demonstrations, all sorts of pressure groups formed on one side or the other of this issue, and this has been going on for some 15 years now. It is no secret, of course, who is behind most of the pro-abortion pushes. These are the province of humanists and women's rights activists in the main. This doesn't mean that other people aren't involved, but these are the primary groups that are pushing this. And the women's rights activists have made it very clear in some of their publications that they would like abortion to be as common as going shopping. It should amount to no more than that, shouldn't matter to anyone any more than that. And they point with pride to some women who've had as many as 27 abortions, apparently with no bad physical repercussions, the way they tell it. Now, what they do not tell us is that a vast number of people who use abortions for this reason are also guilty of promiscuous behavior. These go hand in hand many times. And I think we forget this whole side of the issue when we debate the abortion issue. The vast majority of abortions occur because of sin. If sin hadn't been committed, there would be no abortion in the first place. Because a non-conceived child cannot be aborted. We're told in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18, that we are to flee sexual immorality. And that means exactly what it says. Stay away from situations where you're tempted to be immoral. Run from those situations. Get out of there. Don't stay there. Because this is a sin that can't be committed by one. So if you leave, the sin can't happen. And that's exactly what God is telling us. But you see, the sad thing about this is that almost always immorality causes a consequence. And I think this is what God was talking about to the Jewish people in Numbers 32, verse 23, when he said, "You have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. There will be a consequence. You will not get by with this. You will not go scot-free. You're going to have to pay for it." And I think that's almost invariably true. We're told in Isaiah 59, verse 12, our sins testify against us. They do that individually. They lower our own self-concept. They destroy our own self-esteem. And they also testify against us in the community. People look at us, "Have you heard about her? You know what she's been doing?" Oh, yes, they tell people all about us. Now, in the natural situation, sometimes women naturally abort children. We call this miscarriage. And this is unfortunate, but we don't equate any sin with this most of the time, although many miscarriages are caused by abuse. And there is sin involved there. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this next part of what I'm talking about, because the problem of homosexuality has some very disturbing political overtones. This isn't only a moral issue. This is a political issue that could get worse and worse and might have some serious problems down the road that the church is going to have to deal with directly. Because, you see, homosexuals are not like any other group in the United States. Overall, they are neither poor nor are they uneducated. Now, I know they cry long and loudly that they are an abused minority, but they're not like any other minority, because many of these people are wealthy, many of them are well-educated. In addition, many of them hold important and sometimes positions greatly admired in our country. Some of them are artists, musicians, dramatists, writers, actors. Some are high-ranking politicians, lawyers, publishers, preachers, teachers, etc. Now, I'm speaking of people who have clout and money. Consequently, they can help finance presidential campaigns and thus expect presidential favors. They play on the sympathies of the American people by calling themselves a persecuted minority and by complaining long and loudly about such things as gay bopping. You remember the three sailors who were in the news not so long ago? It's been less than a year. They wandered by mistake into a gay bar, asked to use the restroom, and then apparently no one had the straight of exactly what happened. Now, the gay community intended to use that incident to elicit the sympathy and the support of the American people for their persecuted selves. It backfired this time. George Primpton, who was the major figure in that claim of gay bopping, has a criminal background as long as your arm. Among other things, he's been convicted of drunken driving 3 times, assault, selling drugs. He's been convicted 2x of stealing, 1x of fraud, and a host of other smaller offenses. Now, this is the heroic individual who is involved in this. He started the fight. He caused the whole problem with the three Marines. Yet this man has been feted and royally treated as a martyr of an oppressed and abused minority. He has been on 7 talk shows, some of them New York syndicated programs that covered the whole nation. He has been written up in newspaper and in magazines, always presented as a heroic figure. Everything this man has said is a bald-faced lie. Yet, he is continually held up as a martyr of this movement. Now, what about the three sailors? They were freed by the court. Incidentally, I suppose we would have to say good fortune smiled upon us when the judge was selected to hear that case, because she was a young black woman. Now, if she had been white, either male or female, discrimination would have been the scream so loud you'd have heard it from coast to coast. But since she was a young black woman, the whole thing just blew up in their face. Now, make no mistake, this gay community can fail 20 times. But if they succeed once in arousing the sympathy of the American people for their cause, they are going to progress tremendously, because the American press is squarely behind them all the way. Now, did you get what I just said? The press is pro-homosexual. And it has been from the beginning. For example, on July 16th of this year, just a little while ago, an article came out in many of the large newspapers, and this one found its way into the Springfield paper. And here is a big black headline proclaiming that research links genetic design with homosexuality. Big headlines. But when we read the article, in which they claim that there is a gene which is typical of homosexual brothers in 33 out of 40 cases which they investigated. They also tell us down in the small print that they can't identify that gene. But look what they do. In the headline, they say that they're linked, and yet they have to admit they can't identify it. Now, I would ask this question that has to be asked with all research, and it isn't answered, of course, in this article. The question is this: is the gene there before homosexual activity, or does it develop afterward? And we're not going to find an answer to that question. We won't be told. Now, why I'm saying this is this: the press will magnify, exaggerate, and outright lie to the American public in support of homosexuality as a natural genetic trait. Make no mistake about that. The homosexual community, along with a few other persons, has absolutely hornswoggled the American public. They have made us all look like a bunch of know-nothings. We have been royally taken by this group. Every time you listen to the media, and you do so for a week, you're going to hear something about how horrible AIDS is. And you've been hearing this for quite a long time now. Magic Johnson aided these people enormously. I don't think he was in with them, but he aided them enormously when he said, all over the media, if I can get AIDS, anyone can. And that's what they wanted him to say. You see, the two people who dominate the AIDS statistics, the homosexual and the needle-injecting drug addict, those two groups are not all that popular in some quarters. Therefore, if they had asked for massive infusions of money for the benefit of those two groups, how much money would they have received? Probably not very much. But if they can make us believe that this threatens every single one of us, then we're all willing to dig down. And this is the big sell, because the media has done everything they can to make us believe that every one of us is at risk. Now, if we look at this realistically and just look at the cold, hard facts, we will see what's happened. 3% of the total number of people who have AIDS are heterosexual activists. 2.3% of the people who have AIDS are hemophiliacs, and in a case or two, another person received it by blood transfusion. From dentists, doctors, nurses, accidents, if you will, you have about the same chance of getting AIDS as being electrocuted by your electronic garage door closer. Very slim, in other words. In excess of 85% then of all AIDS cases are gays and intravenous drug users. Now, what do they stand to gain by making all of us believe that we're all at risk? Well, this is what they gained. In 1992, we spent $2 billion on AIDS research, and it is the number 9 killer. 196,000 deaths in 1992. 2.7 million deaths to cardiovascular disease. 1.7 million to cancer. Do you know how much we spent on cardiovascular disease, the number one killer, far and away? $763 million. That's the number one killer. And on the number nine killer, thanks to the media, thanks to the big selling campaign, thanks to the lies and misrepresentation, 2 billion dollars. And who does that benefit? Almost entirely, intravenous drug users and homosexuals. They get the bulk of the benefit from that because practically all people with AIDS come from those two groups. So they get $2 billion, and all of the people with heart disease get $763 million. A lot of things that we don't see, a lot of things that we don't consider. AIDS are not a threat to everyone. Anyone with sense enough to behave decently is not at risk at all. I would say that hardly anyone in this building is at risk of getting AIDS. Simply what you know will prevent it. What you believe will prevent it. And just remember these things. For every person who dies of AIDS, 16 die of cancer. For every person who dies of AIDS, 28 die of cardiovascular disease. Remind yourself that there are two traffic fatalities for every one person who dies with AIDS. There are 2+ people who die from pneumonia for every person who dies of AIDS. Now just remember a few of those things, and maybe we won't be quite such a soft touch the next time around. As a matter of fact, how generous should we be in opening our pocketbooks and giving money for AIDS research? Think about that. Think about why it occurs. Think about where it comes from, and just ask yourself that question. And sometimes it might make a difference. Now, we in this country can say any hateful thing we want to our president or any other dignitary, unless we happen to be in the military service. This, however, does not take into account God's law at all, does it? Because I'm told in Romans 13, verse 1, 2, that the governing authorities that exist were ordained by God. He put those people there, and He put them there to be respected. He put them there to be obeyed, not ridiculed, not called all sorts of names. In fact, when we resist those laws that are God's laws, when we resist those ordinances, we are resisting God. 1 Peter 2:17. Now, Peter also tells us to honor the king, and this would equate to any position of authority. That position is to be respected. Paul told Timothy, and this was something he wanted him to teach to the churches that he worked with. He said, this is chapter 2, of the first book, verses 1 through 3, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and notice this, for all who are in authority. Why? That we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence, for this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. In other words, God put authority, all levels of authority, in order that we might have an orderly society. And he tells us that this is good. We can lead a quiet and peaceable life if we have an orderly society. And that's why he wants us to obey and respect authorities. So the child of God cannot malign authority. We simply cannot behave that way. No matter how much we might disagree with what they do, no matter how appalled we might be at some of the things they say, we nonetheless must respect that position because it is God ordained. And we cannot work against God. Liberal thinking abounds in our country. Liberal thinking essentially means that anyone can be rehabilitated. Anyone. That no criminal should ever be wasted, he should be rehabilitated. Now, also within the circle of liberalism is the idea that criminals are not really to blame for much of what they do. Because, well, some have come from broken homes. Some were abused when they were small. They had drunk fathers and mothers, or their mother perhaps shot drugs. So society is to blame. They aren't at fault. And we are expert in this country at absolving criminals from guilt and blaming society. And in this way, no one gets blamed, because society is a big, vague, general area where you can't fix blame. So no one gets blamed. And the criminal goes on his way. This is why we give home visitation to criminals. This is why we furlough dangerous people. This is why we reduce sentences. This is why we plea bargain. This is why we allow a drunken driver to have a half dozen wrecks before we take any action at all to take him off the streets. Men who abuse their wives and children, we're talking here about liberalism in law, men who abuse their wives and children will typically be freed several times, and when they're freed, they go home angrier than they were before to abuse more severely than they did before. It's very, very difficult, in other words, to get a definitive action by the law in cases where action is desperately needed. And this idea of liberal treatment of criminals, you'll find that in many communities. For instance, in Miller County, you can commit a murder, and if you're tried by jury, the odds are that you'll be acquitted. And that's well known all over the state of Missouri. So if you want to kill somebody, drive up to Miller County. Because chances are you'll get by with it. Because the people of Miller County just don't convict anyone in juries. I really don't know why that is. But that's the reputation the community has. You could have gone to Waynesville, Missouri, a few years ago and gotten by with almost anything because the prosecutor wouldn't prosecute anyone. And yet they had three prosecutors in succession there who wouldn't prosecute anyone. Our whole system of law is permeated with the liberal concept. Worse in some areas than in others. But that whole concept says that arresting authorities are reluctant to push cases into court, and that prosecutors and others are reluctant to try them. Rape victims usually don't even report it. They usually don't. And the reason for that is that either nothing will be done, or by the time the questioning and all has gone on, they will feel more like the cause than the victim. So most of them don't even report it. Why is it that our street police allow you to exceed the speed limit by 5 to 10 miles an hour and then sometimes do nothing about it? Why do we post a sign that says 20 miles an hour and allow everyone to drive 30? Well, it's the very same concept. We don't want to enforce the laws. That hurts people's feelings. That makes drivers angry. So we don't want to bother them. Now, you can go out on any highway in this state or any other state, and if you drive 55 miles an hour, I promise you, unless it is Saturday and there are a number of old pickups on the road, you will be about the only person driving the speed limit for long periods of time. Who does anything about it? Nobody. Just let them go. And all of this is because of that liberal idea of being easy on lawbreakers, easy on criminals. Now, I don't believe that God believes in coddling criminals. I don't think he agrees in overlooking lawbreakers. I believe God sees things that way at all. We're told in Romans 13, verse 4, if you do evil, or if you break laws, be afraid. Now, afraid of who? The person in whom authority is vested. You're supposed to be afraid of that person because he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister. Notice these words. An avenger to execute wrath on him who breaks the laws. Now that is the function. That's the function of the person in authority. That's what he is supposed to do. He is to be an avenger. Now, an avenger is one who punishes people who do wrong. That's the role of an avenger. That's what he does. And the word execute means to carry out fully. Now, this is the only person I know of in the Scripture besides God who is entitled to be wrathful. You and I aren't, because we're told the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God. But the authority figure is allowed to be wrathful. He is allowed to be vindicative because he is to avenge or punish evil. And he has permission by God to be this way because of the role he plays. But how many people in that role behave like that at all? Very, very few. In 1 Peter chapter 2, there is a passage I'd like to share with you quickly, beginning in verse 13. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors, or to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God. This is why we do this, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Show them, in other words, that you are free people, yet you are not using your liberty as a cloak for vice, but you're behaving as a servant of God. Now that's the rationale that God has for us. God has given us liberty, but not to break laws. And we cannot claim I have the God-given right to break a law. I can never use that liberty to cover something wrong. Never use that excuse. So we should be model law keepers, never law breakers. And while society all around us breaks them willy-nilly whenever they please, we cannot and must not do that. Not if we expect to please God. Let me invite you to consider Genesis 9, verses 2 through 6. Because this is a passage that predates the law of Moses and has nothing to do with the law of Moses. I don't know why people sometimes put it with it, but it doesn't belong there. And let me just ask this question. I'm not going to elaborate on this, but let me just ask this question. If verses 2 and 4 are still true, are verses 5 and 6 still true? Specifically the statement, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man will his blood be shed." That wasn't part of the law of Moses. That predates the law. This was God's intention, apparently, when he was giving instructions just after the flood. This is how he wanted men to think. I'll just leave that with you. Now, lawyers and judges who are involved in a trial often assume that everyone is lying. This is the common assumption. And that sometimes includes the lawyer. Sometimes he's lying too. There isn't anyone there who's telling the truth. I have been a witness twice, both times in a divorce case. And in both instances, the prosecuting attorney had a very clear, obvious intent to take evident, plain facts, twist them, misrepresent them, deny them, and then try to make me admit that he's right. We both knew he was lying. He knew it, and I knew it. But that made no difference. That was his job. Now, some attorneys advise their clients, and I've heard them do it. Don't admit anything. In other words, tell lies of omission. Don't tell all the truth. Omit part of it. Those are lies of omission. Now, a friend of mine recently was involved in a court situation. Some of the sheets of assets, which were held by the two of them, some of those were not correct. And the prosecutor got one that had several assets left off. The lawyer specifically advised this person, when you are asked, are these all the assets, you say yes. Because under law, what isn't mentioned won't be involved in the trial. But in order to keep it from being mentioned, you must lie. And the person was clearly advised to lie. So I ask this question, how can you get at the truth in a courtroom when everyone is lying? And when sometimes the defense and the offense are also based on lies, how are you going to get at the truth? In a recent book called The Legal Merry-Go-Round, this writer took the position that that's what a court was, just kind of like a merry-go-round. You go around and around and around and around, and somewhere it stops, and on whatever it says when you stop, that's the decision. But you don't arrive at it by logic, and you don't get there by finding out what the truth is, because those are both unknown sometimes in the situation. So the courtroom has become a game room, and the object of each side is to trick the other. Now, I wish I didn't have to say this, but it's true. This is a shame and a disgrace. But that's exactly the way it happens. Now, there are perhaps courtrooms where none of this applies. I hope so. I've just never been around one where it didn't. Now, God doesn't allow us to play games with the truth. He just simply doesn't. We are to put away lying and speak the truth to our acquaintances. That's Ephesians 5:25. We're just not to lie, we're to speak the truth. And we're told in Colossians 3:9, do not lie to one another, because lying was a part of the old man, and you put him off with his deeds. You're a new person, so you're not supposed to lie. We're told in Revelation 22:15 that people who practice lying will not be in heaven. They just won't be there. So God does not smile on liars. Solomon said it right in Proverbs 19:9, he who speaks lies shall perish. And that's exactly the way it is. Now, those who enforce civil laws, and I'm speaking here of the people you see on the streets every day, those in uniform. Now, those persons are to obey speed limits unless they have lights or siren on. But it's not uncommon for them to go by you so hard your car rocks. No siren, no lights. In other words, the people who are supposed to uphold the law are themselves commonly guilty of breaking it. There is a 3-block area in Springfield, not far from where I work, where the speed limit is 20 miles an hour, and that's because there are streets and alleys coming just every few feet on both sides. It's a very dangerous area. Also, 3 traffic lights there. But the typical Springfield policeman goes through there anywhere from 40 to 60 miles an hour. Not a sign of a light on, no siren. Just as if everybody get out of my way, here I come. No official business. And the question is this. If they are to enforce the law and they themselves break it, then who enforces it? And I guess the answer is no one. I could go on at great length on that, but I'm not going to. I'd like to talk to the young men in the audience for just a moment here and it will be a moment. In the United States, we have a boomeranging problem with young boys. There is an age at which they congregate in groups. Being part of a group is vitally important to a boy between the ages of 12 and 17. And we're speaking here of boys who are 13, 14. They used to break windows. They used to throw rolls of toilet paper over trees and do other things that were exasperating but not terribly harmful. Now, they're involved in more dangerous games. Now they're gang raping and killing girls. This is their sport. And this is becoming increasingly common. The FBI says that in the past 5 years, this kind of activity has increased 85%. So we're dealing here with a serious problem with our young men in America. This used to be a teenage problem. Then it became a problem of 14 and 15, and now it is 10, 11, and 12-year-old boys involved in such things. If you read 1984 by George Orwell, you know that he said it would be like this. This was a secular thinker, but this was his forecast, and he was exactly right. Now, they talk about single parents, television, movies, and a lot of other things as contributing to this problem, but the thing that has contributed most is just something rotten in our culture. I don't think that the women's liberation movement ever really intended this to happen. But women are no longer respected. Our girls are no longer respected. Men give no honor to the weaker sex. They are fair game. And that's how our whole country thinks. Woman has no special protection from a man. He's bigger and stronger, so he takes whatever advantage he wishes. We have had a complete breakdown of traditional morals. And the women's liberation movement, by insisting that women be treated like men, has caused a lot of this. There is so much material in this area, so much that I can say, but I'm going to close here because I've been talking long enough. But let me conclude with this. We live in an age when total disrespect for the law is almost universal. Almost universal. I have many times counted as many as 500 people breaking the law when I'm driving legally. I have sometimes driven for 70 miles and never encountered another person who was obeying the speed limits. Remember what Jesus said, that if you offend in small ways, you will offend in greater. You can bank on it. People who will break laws so carelessly this way will break other laws just as carelessly. Therefore, if you're a child of God and you obey the law, you are an oddity right now. You are right now an oddity. Because the fact that you are obeying the law causes you to be an impediment to other people and their movement and their actions, and they view you as the lawbreaker rather than themselves. In other words, if you can't drive faster than that buddy, get off the road. That's the way they think. And you're obeying the law. So we have had a complete reversal of roles. In the past 60 years, we have really come full circle. We used to respect people who obeyed the laws, told the truth, were moral, etc., etc. And we had little respect for people who were not this way. They were pariahs, almost outcasts in the community. Most of us had little or nothing to do with them. Now, the people who obey the laws, who are moral, who try to do what's right, are the exceptions. And we are just as much pariahs, just as much outcasts as they used to be. God's laws are a joke to the society in which we live. A joke. But that doesn't mean that to us.